collection, $75, with the book, $125, with the eating DVD, $160 for the whole package, or you can have the eating DVD by itself, $75. The last few minutes to get this information. Let it pass by. So we're going to start to go out now. Here we go. As Harold Melvin and the, well, Teddy Pendergrass, actually, via Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes saying, wake up, everybody. Here we go. We're going to go out. Don't forget, keep calling, 212-209-2950. That's right. He said it back in the 70s, but this song was written in the 70s. So we still have a lot of work to do, right? We're not there yet.
Quite a bit of work to do, Piggy. Quite a bit.
Yeah, here we go. Keep calling, 212-209-29. I'm going to leave, Michael. Bye-bye. Thanks, everybody. Thanks so much, everybody who pledged this radio station. Thank you.
Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking. Time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, 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 oh. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out. They do it every time.
Hi, New York. It's Esther Armar from Wake Up Call. It is that time again, WBAI's Fun Drive. Do you have an hour that you can spare in those early mornings from 6 till 8? I really hope so, because Wake Up Call needs you. With you at the end of that telephone, together we can make sure that Wake Up Call has a successful fun drive, but we really do need your help. So please, come on down. If you want to volunteer, give Vera a call on 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. We would so appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Esther Armar. And you are tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.org. It's 6 p.m. in New York City. Please stay tuned for a report of some of the day's events with the WBAI news team.
Good evening. In the news tonight, President Obama announces $8 billion in federal loan guarantees for the construction of new nuclear power plants. Good government advocates call on New York City Council members to turn down $500,000 in extra pay. And environmentalists in New Jersey cry foul as Governor Christie seizes funds to close that state's budget gap. With these and other stories, I'm Andrea Sears in New York, and this is the news for Tuesday, February 16th, 2010. The lawyer representing family members of police shooting victim Sean Bell says the U.S. Justice Department has told him it will not seek federal civil rights violation charges against the officers who killed Sean Bell. The unarmed Bell died in a hail of 50 police bullets outside a Queens nightclub in November 2006. Two friends, Trent Benefield and Joseph Guzman, were wounded. Three police detectives involved in the shooting were acquitted of any wrongdoing in April 2008. City Council member Charles Barron, among others, had asked the U.S. Justice Department to charge the officers in federal court, but according to attorney Sanford Rubenstein, who represents some members of the Bell family, the Justice Department has told him there will be no federal charges. Councilmember Barron called the decision an outrageous, gross miscarriage of justice. A Justice Department statement said there was insufficient evidence to pursue charges against the officers. The family of Sean Bell can now go ahead with a civil lawsuit against the New York City Police Department. Bell was killed the day he was supposed to be married. President Barack Obama today announced more than $8 billion in loan guarantees to build the first nuclear power plant in 30 years. The president did not mention the name of the recipient of the loan guarantees by name, but administration officials said the guarantees would go to help energy giant the Southern Company build two nuclear reactors at a plant in the state of Georgia. Environmentalists quickly seized on the announcement to reiterate decades-long concerns about the safety of nuclear power. They also questioned whether committing taxpayers to covering the cost of a nuclear facility was a wise investment, given the dozens of nuclear plant projects that were started over the past three decades but never completed. WBAI's Jose Santiago discussed the issue with Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at Public Citizen, one of the nation's largest consumer advocacy groups.
This is a huge risk for the public at a time when we can least afford it. Nuclear power has proven itself to be one of the worst investments in the energy sector. For generations, nuclear power plants have been consistently behind schedule and over budget, and the numerous risks posed by nuclear power, both the safety and security of these facilities, really render it an unacceptable risk for taxpayers, particularly when cost-competitive technologies are available that are superior to nuclear power, like wind, solar, and investments in efficiency. This conditional $8.3 billion loan guarantee, the federal government has already estimated that there's a 50% estimated default rate on these loan guarantees for new nuclear power plants because of the strong possibility that they will be significantly over budget and behind schedule. So at a time when taxpayers are facing enormous risks, huge budget deficits, President Obama's announcement that he is going to secure more than $8 billion in guaranteed loans to a single corporation to build a risky energy project just is unacceptable.
Do we have any idea or has there been any research on whether or not this is one of these companies that have been making a lot of political contributions, et cetera? Have they bought their way toward these loans?
Oh, well, there's no question. I mean, Southern Company has spent $70 million lobbying the federal government since 2005. This is a company that's extremely profitable. They've earned almost $16 billion in operating income since 2005. So this is a large, powerful, profitable corporation that has spent nearly $70 million just in the last couple of years trying to influence the political process. So there's no question that Southern has strong political ties. It is aggressive about spending money to lobby for its own special interests in Washington, D.C. And there's no question, of course, that that plays a role in selecting a single company to receive more than $8 billion in loan guarantees. Could you imagine if President Obama announced an $8 billion loan guarantee program for working families to help them afford to install solar panels on millions of roofs, or to give loan guarantees for families and landlords to make energy efficiency improvements to our buildings and homes? The fact is that the reason that the nuclear power industry has been able to successfully petition Congress to give it billions of dollars in guarantees, despite the fact that it's deeply flawed, is because of the political influence that the industry has over both political parties, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. My understanding is that the availability of loans to energy companies is something that has been approved by lawmakers in Washington. Could you clarify what the situation is and whether or not this amount of money going to one company means that other alternative energy sources might not have as much money available.
Well, yeah, I mean, the sheer size and expense of building new reactors, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission estimates that a single new reactor is going to cost around $10 billion. When the federal government is securing loans for a massively expensive single project like that, that is taking away available public financing for competing technologies, such as wind and solar, that don't feature the significant safety and security concerns that nuclear power has. And so the huge cost of these new reactors really crowds out public financing for competing renewable technologies. And you have to remember, you know, Wall Street is investing heavily in wind and solar and other types of renewable energy technologies. Wall Street is not getting behind nuclear power because it is simply too risky. And I don't want to see the American public become the fall guy to ensure and guarantee tens of billions of dollars worth of loans to a handful of nuclear power companies when the risks are just too high.
What about the environmental risk, aside from the possibility that they could take this money and wind up not at the end of many years even producing a power plant that begins generating electricity? But environmentally speaking, what are some of the thoughts of your organization?
Oh, well, the environmental hazards of nuclear power are significant. Generating electricity from a nuclear reaction creates thousands of tons of highly radioactive waste across the country. And storing this waste is neither secure nor safe. And right now you've got almost 25% of the more than 100 reactors that are currently operating in the United States have experienced radioactive tritium leaks into groundwater. And in fact, there's a huge controversy in Vermont right now over a nuclear power plant that is leaking radioactive tritium that has now reached the Connecticut River. So those who claim that nuclear power is emissions-free or a environmentally clean, that is a laughable comment. The fact is nuclear power is dangerous.
These loan guarantees announced today, this is a done deal, or is there any legislative role in this? What could happen?
Oh, Congress can always come in and try to rewrite these rules that allow the loan guarantees. And the loan guarantees are conditional on the completion of the full licensing procedure that Southern Company is going through in order to try to build these reactors. So this is not a done deal. So, you know, listeners out there ought to be concerned, weighing in with your senators and members of Congress to say, why on earth should federal taxpayers directly subsidize two new nuclear reactors down in Georgia? It doesn't make any sense. The vast majority of the public aren't going to benefit from this. The main beneficiary of this is the Southern Company. Like I said, a company that's had $16 billion in profit since 2005. This is a very influential, powerful corporation with strong political ties. They've spent over $70 million lobbying the federal government on energy issues since 2005. So this really talks more about political patronage than it does about sound technology.
Tyson Slocum is with Public Citizen. He was interviewed by WBAI's Jose Santiago. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Andrea Sears. The New York Times is reporting that a federal judge in Manhattan today ruled that the city of New York did not violate the constitutional rights of cyclists by requiring them to file for parade permits when they rode in groups of 50 or more. The ruling is a blow to organizers of the critical mass bike ride protests in Manhattan. The judge, Louis Kaplan of the Southern District of New York, said that he was sympathetic to the plaintiffs' concerns and acknowledged their inconvenience. However, Judge Kaplan said the parade regulations and their enforcement by the New York Police Department did not violate the Constitution. In 2007, the Five Boroughs Bike Club filed a lawsuit after the police department changed its rules, saying it would ticket or arrest a group of 50 cyclists or more who did not have a parade permit. The Five Boroughs Bike Club said that they looked into applying for permits, but said the process was a bureaucratic nightmare. During the Republican National Convention in 2004, more than 100 cyclists were arrested for disorderly conduct after a group of about 5,000 rode past Madison Square Garden protesting President Bush. After the court said the rules were too vague, the police department then sought to change rules, arguing that smaller groups of cyclists were safer and disrupted less traffic. Every year, the Speaker of the City Council doles out $500,000 in extra pay to council members. The payments, called Lulus, are supposed to be compensation for the extra work members take on when they head a committee or hold leadership positions. But Citizen Union calls these bonuses unnecessary and is urging reform of the system. And today they launched the City Council Lulu Watch on their website to track what each of the 51 members of the council does with his or her Lulu this year. Dick Dady, executive director of the Citizen Union, says the city shouldn't be passing out these stipends, particularly when the budget is so tight.
What's so abhorrent about it is that just about every member of the city council, 46 of them, get this extra wad of cash, this Lulu, for the extra work that they do above and beyond that of being a regular council member, you know, chairing a committee. So there are many more committees than there need to be, largely so that every council member possible can get a Lulu, which ranges anywhere from amounts from $4,000 to $28,000. The average is over $10,000.
There are 46 council members who get Lulus out of the 51. Somehow it seems like everybody's doing extra work.
Yeah, that's the argument, is that there are 40-plus committees in the city council which all require a chair, and you're not necessarily elected to be a chair of a city council committee or elected to be a regular city council member, so they see it as extra work requiring extra pay. But already it's a part-time job. They get the $112,500 salary, which is quite a significant salary for essentially what is a part-time job. And the argument can be made that chairing the committee takes extra work, no question about it. But council committees are created sometimes for the purpose of being able to give out a Lulu from the speaker. So the speaker buys the loyalty of many of the city council members because of the extra cash he gives them.
Or she gives them in this case. Now, how did these come into being? Was this simply something that was put into the budget and has stayed there forever?
Yeah, it's been in there for some time, actually. And it's been a practice that dates back decades. So it's not something that's new, but it's kind of an old practice that has just been allowed to continue. Congress ended the practice some 30 years ago. I mean, we don't see members of Congress who chair very important committees, such as Foreign Affairs or Ways and Means. I mean, Charlie Rangel chairs the Ways and Means Committee. He doesn't earn any more money than a Republican member of the House from Alabama who doesn't chair a committee.
In 2005 and 2009, Citizen Unions evaluated candidates on their position on the Lulus. Several candidates, while running for office, had said that they would do away with them. Have they actually followed through?
No, they haven't. This is the head-scratcher. We had over 20 members of the city council who said that they did not support Lulus and, in fact, would oppose the awarding of Lulus. They didn't vote against the Lulus when the Lulus were presented as part of an overall council organization plan at the beginning of the year. Granted, the Lulus weren't separated out. They were part of one larger motion to adopt the whole, how the council operates overall. So there wasn't an opportunity to vote specifically against Lulus. But what some council members have done is that they've actually gone ahead and refused the Lulus. But still a majority of those that said that they would oppose Lulus have decided to pocket the money, which is just outrageous.
In general, how is the city council doing in policing itself and being sure that it is being responsible, even with their own salaries, to be sure that the city's money is being spent wisely?
Well, you know, every 4 years there's this commission on compensation that makes recommendations on what elected officials should receive for their salary. And when the commission came out 4 years ago and made a number of recommendations, one of the recommendations was that the council should end this practice of awarding stipends, address the issue of whether the council should be full-time or part-time, and then the commission would take a look at what kind of a salary is appropriate. The council, unfortunately, has failed to address these issues, and they're still on the plate, and we need to have them addressed. I mean, the council makes a lot of money. Many of them work very hard, no question about it, and are deserving of this. But the stipends are not there so much for the extra income, but rather for the speaker to be able to control the members in a way that allows her to, so to speak, buy the loyalty of them on issues that she needs them there for.
Is there any variable in there? Does the speaker actually have control over how much goes to whom, or if?
Oh yeah, no. The speaker decides. You know, Leroy Comrie, I'm going to give you a $20,000 stipend to chair the land use committee. Maria Arroyo, I'm going to give you $10,000 to chair the health committee. So and so, I'm going to give you $4,000 to chair this small subcommittee. So she has the ability to dole out these member items and to assign what each of these committees get based on what she wants from them.
So it's not really like a payroll. It is a reward for favoritism system one way or the other.
It's a rewarding system that the council speaker has available to her to play favorites.
Has there been any organized effort beyond simply polling the members to actually do away with this?
Yes. I mean, we not only did we get the council members on record as candidates for city council during this past fall, but we have contacted each of them, asking them to be true to their word and to oppose the awarding of stipends and to refuse the stipends if offered. And as I said, we have now 11 members of the city council, something we've never had before. We only had two in the last council. The council that lasted 4 years, from 2006 to 2009, returned the non-lose. In the early part of 2010, we now have 11, but we still have 15 to go, who at one point indicated that they would oppose these Lulus.
And is there anything else coming up on this?
This commission that put forward this report in 2006 is going to again be meeting next year in early 2011. And we hope very much that this whole issue will be again addressed. And so the whole issue of stipends will be addressed, the whole issue of compensation for the city council will be addressed. But what's interesting is that if more and more council members get on the bandwagon and return their stipends or donate their stipends to charity, so they don't feel like they are beholden to the speaker as a result of the awarding of these stipends, and we get a majority of the council turning back the stipends, then why should we have the system at all? That if individual council members are willing to stand up and be independent and not have the speaker bear some authority over them by virtue of awarding these stipends, and they undercut the power inherent in the awarding of these stipends, then why not get rid of the entire practice? That's what we're hoping for over the next couple of months.
Dick Dady is executive director of the Citizen Union. The City Council Lulu Watch can be found online at www.citizensunion.org. Last week, the governor of New Jersey declared a fiscal state of emergency, a series of proposed cuts to budgets and programs that will fill a $2.2 billion budget gap for 2010. $158 million of that will come from the money left in the Clean Energy Fund. Governor Christie says the money is being captured, but environmentalists call it a raid on a fund they say the governor has no right to touch. WBAI's Christine Black files this report.
The governor's proposed cuts are deep and wide. Local schools, colleges, hospitals, and the Office of Public Advocate would see their funding reduced or cut altogether. There are also cuts for the environment. New Jersey Transit, the conservation group the Highlands Council, the Department of Environmental Protection, state parks, and the Pinelands Commission will see reductions in their funding. But the cut environmentalists are most upset about is to the Clean Energy Fund. Matt Elliott is with Environment New Jersey.
The problem here is that this is ratepayer money. So every person in New Jersey, every business in New Jersey pays into this fund every year. It's just a small amount on everybody's utility bill, but in the end it adds up to a big pot of money that helps fund clean energy programs. This is not money for the governor to use at his discretion. It's money that we've all put in with the understanding that it would be used to help bring more clean energy to our grid and also to help us all save energy.
Everyone who pays for electricity and gas in New Jersey pays the societal benefit charge. 58% of that money goes towards the Clean Energy Fund, around $269 million a year. It's that pot of money that helps fuel the clean energy sector and an estimated 20,000 jobs.
We're now one of the nation's leaders on solar power because of this fund. You know, we have over 100 solar companies all across New Jersey. We have more solar than any state except California. And it's all because we've built the solar market in the state through the use of this renewable energy fund.
But advocates worry that raiding the fund now will send the wrong message to investors. Another aspect of the fund, 56% of it goes towards improving energy efficiency in homes and businesses.
It helps people save energy and it helps businesses save energy. So that's good for the individual that retrofits their home and has more money in their pocket. It's also good for the state as a whole. Because of this program alone, we've avoided the need to build several medium-sized power plants in New Jersey, which are expensive. They take a long time to build.
And to reduce the CO2 emissions that are responsible for global climate change. And for every dollar spent on energy efficiency, there's a $3 return on investment. So how can ratepayers see a return on their investment in the societal benefit charge?
One is through a direct benefit. So if somebody goes to the fund and gets a rebate for a solar project, you know, it allows them to have the money on hand to build solar on their rooftop. Or if they go and they want to retrofit their home, they can have some money in their pocket to afford the initial upfront cost. So it's good for anybody who kind of goes directly to the fund and applies for a rebate to make their home greener or more efficient. It's also good for the whole state, though, because when we reduce energy demand, we're saving the need to build new expensive power plants. We're also making sure that there's more energy supply available so that everybody's bills and everybody's rates come down.
Governor Christie has proposed taking the remaining $158 million left in the fund for 2010 and using it to help fill the budget gap. Again, Environment New Jersey's Matt Elliott.
First, we want to get the word out about what impact this raid will have to New Jersey's economy and to the clean energy market that we've worked so hard to grow. We started by getting the word out to our members. You know, we have thousands and thousands of members all over the state, and we're letting them know what this would mean to clean energy in New Jersey, and we're calling on them to contact the governor and let him know that this is the wrong way forward for New Jersey.
By declaring a fiscal state of emergency like those declared, say, after a snowstorm, the newly elected Republican governor may have damaged any bipartisan feelings his Democratic colleagues in the legislature may have had. Is the governor allowed to make these cuts unilaterally?
The legislature, I think, is starting to pay attention, and they're holding a set of hearings this week and for the next couple of weeks to really understand the impact of all of the governor's proposals. We think it's something that only the legislature can do, and only the legislature has discretion over how this money's spent. And, you know, if it does get rerouted, it should be up to the legislature, but we're trying to look into that.
For now, the environmentalists are lobbying for the best possible outcome during these tough economic times.
We'll be in the legislature and, you know, talking to our elected officials and telling them what impact this would have and really urging them to work with the governor and work with each other across party lines to protect this money and make sure that we have a good, solid fund for clean energy moving forward.
Calls to Governor Christie's office for comment were not returned. For WBAI, I'm Christine Black.
And finally tonight, commentator Playfell Benjamin has been following President Obama's foreign policy initiatives, finding in some cases welcome change, but in others, moves that appear misguided or even dangerous. Of particular concern, American military provocations to China and Russia, which Benjamin calls a prescription for disaster.
Since we know that President Obama is a highly intelligent man, who for the most part has pursued a foreign policy that is something different and something more than that of his predecessor, there seems to be only one rational explanation for some of the irrational decisions the Obama administration is making in dealing with China and Russia. They are locked in a master narrative that bears little resemblance to historical truth or present reality. A poignant example of the extent to which they are servants of historical fictions is the Obama administration's decision to sell advanced military weaponry to the de facto island nation of Taiwan, which the Chinese have contended for over half a century is a part of China. This is a clear insult to Chinese prestige and a threat to their national security. To compound the insult and heighten the threat, Congress bans the sale of these same sophisticated weapon systems to China. 50 years ago, the U.S. could get away with such offenses with impunity, but it could prove costly in today's world. China is no longer a technologically backward semi-feudal nation in the process of modernization. It is a financial power that is the major U.S. creditor, and a rapidly rising technological colossus whose universities are turning out 10 times the number of engineers as U.S. universities. Furthermore, the Chinese have a massive, well-armed and trained army which would prove invincible in the face of any land invasion, which means that our military options would rapidly turn to nuclear weapons. President Bush's decision to unilaterally withdraw from the anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia in 2002, which forbade the deployment of missile defense systems except in one location on their home territory and prohibited developing advanced technology that could cover larger areas, was bad enough. But President Obama's decision to build a defensive missile system in nations that were once allied with Russia is an even more dangerous game. Predictably, the Russians have declared these developments and NATO expansion in general to be a threat to their national security and their new 10-year military plan. And they have threatened to attack the missile sites if the Romanians attempt to deploy them. The critical questions here are, does the Obama administration believe the Russians are bluffing? And if not, is the nation prepared to go to war with Russia to defend Romania if they're attacked? What would happen to the Obama presidency if the U.S. were forced to back down? And most important of all, is any of this in the national interest of the United States, or are they just playing politics? The fate of the Obama presidency is not the only thing hanging in the balance here, but the fate of the earth as well. This is Playfellow Benjamin with a commentary on The Times.
And that's some of the news for Tuesday, February 16th, 2010. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago and Christine Black. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, February 16th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, Obama announces loan guarantees to build the first new nuclear power plant in three decades. 1 year after the massive federal stimulus bill, some say women and people of color are still waiting for the benefits. And as Olympic fever continues, some groups say organizers are muzzling dissent and violating civil liberties.
Clearly, there's massive money involved here. And you've got to ask yourself, when did the state get into the business of policing private sector commercial rights?
Those stories and more. But first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. At least three more civilians were killed during the military operation in Marja. Two were shot by troops who claim the victims did not heed warnings to stop as they approached NATO forces. The third was mistaken for a militant. Also today, NATO put the High Mobility Artillery Rocket System back online. Its use was suspended yesterday after a missile fired from the system killed 12 civilians. Six of them were children. The manufacturer of the weapon, Lockheed Martin, said that the system has precision reliability. Local officials say the number of civilian deaths may be higher than official reports because people are being killed by landmines placed by the Taliban as they flee. And White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs declined to confirm widespread reports today that the Taliban's second-in-command, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, was arrested in Karachi by a joint U.S.-Pakistan operation earlier this month. Baradar is said to be the top military commander for the Taliban and the most senior member arrested since the 2001 onset of the Afghan War. Hundreds of anti-mining activists are protesting today in northern Argentina following a police crackdown on demonstrators. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
More than 60 people were injured last night when police escorted excavating equipment through a protest blockade at a controversial open-pit mine site in the province of Catamarca. Police fired tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters. Women and children were among the injured. 12 demonstrators were arrested. Activists from the Citizens' Assembly of Andalgalá have been protesting the mine for 2 months. The mine is owned by Agua Rica, a subsidiary of Yamana Gold, a Canadian-based gold producer, which plans to begin mining operations in the town of Andalgalá in 2012. The Citizens' Assembly says that one longtime activist, 50-year-old Aldo Flores, has been missing since yesterday. Flores has been the target of death threats and police harassment in the days leading up to the crackdown. Minerals are Argentina's largest export, valued at nearly $80 billion over the past decade. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
The Department of Justice says they will not bring federal charges against the New York City police officers who killed Sean Bell. Undercover officers fired 50 shots at Bell's car. He died on his wedding day. In 2008, the four officers charged in Bell's murder were acquitted of manslaughter. The banking industry amped up its lobbying efforts last year. Eight firms alone spent almost $30 million on influence, most of it in the last quarter of the year, according to the LA Times. That's an increase of better than 10% over the previous year. The top three spenders in 2009 were J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Morgan Stanley. The banking industry is opposed to parts of the White House proposal for financial services regulations, especially the creation of a consumer protection agency. Maoist rebels attacked a police camp in the Indian state of West Bengal. 25 people are dead and several others wounded. Bismillah Gilani has more.
The attacks happened last evening in Sildah area of the eastern state of West Bengal. Police say soldiers were busy preparing meals when dozens of Maoist rebels entered the camp and opened indiscriminate fire, killing 24 on the spot. Later, the rebels reportedly set fire to the camp and walked away with a huge cache of arms and ammunition. The Maoists have owned the responsibility for the attack. A spokesperson for the guerrillas told a local news agency that the attack is in response to the ongoing military operation against them. The government has recently launched a massive military offensive called the Operation Green Hunt to flush out Maoist rebels who are now active in most Indian states. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News.
Four Burmese activists were sentenced to prison and hard labor yesterday. They were charged with disturbing the peace. The four women were arrested after they provided religious literature to a Buddhist monastery and held regular prayer sessions for the release of opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The sentences were handed down as a UN envoy for human rights, Tomas Quintano, arrived in Rangoon, and Human Rights Watch released a report today warning that the military-led regime may well increase repression of ethnic minority activists as elections approach. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Doreen Marina in New York. Today, President Obama announced $8 billion in loan guarantees to help build a nuclear plant in Georgia. It would be the first nuclear plant built in the U.S. in over 30 years. The president says a renewed focus on nuclear plants will help build the economy, but critics charge it could put both the industry and taxpayers at risk. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Speaking at a job training center in Maryland, President Obama touted the economic benefits of the new nuclear power plant.
It's a plant that will create thousands of construction jobs in the next few years, and some 800 permanent jobs, well-paying permanent jobs, in the years to come. And this is only the beginning. My budget proposes tripling the loan guarantees we provide to help finance safe
clean nuclear facilities.
In his 2011 budget, President Obama added an additional $36 billion for nuclear loan guarantees. It's part of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which gives funds to companies that use innovative energy technology. Obama said he wants nuclear to be part of the U.S. energy plan, but acknowledged the opposition.
There will be those that welcome this announcement, those who think it's been long overdue. But there are also going to be those who strongly disagree with this announcement.
Environmentalists are concerned about radioactive waste and accidents at nuclear plants. But some opponents say the financial risks are just as great. Sarah Barzak is a program director with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. She says there's a long history of nuclear construction starting and stopping.
Costs are going to be spent, and very likely most of these reactors will not be built, and that's where these federal loan guarantees kick in, and the taxpayer will end up footing that bill.
Private companies and investors have also been reluctant to fund nuclear energy. Sharon Squassoni is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She says nuclear power plants are very expensive to build.
There's a lot of money that you need up front, and private capital, for the most part, is not willing to take on those risks. So you need government support.
Some leading financial institutions agree. Citibank in the UK recently released a report that discourages companies from investing in nuclear energy. Squassoni says the time it takes to get a nuclear reactor up and running can also be a factor.
It takes anywhere from 7 to 10 years from start to finish, right, when you start the licensing process to initial construction and, you know, connecting it to the electricity grid.
Despite the expense, the nuclear industry has been pushing to build new plants. According to OpenSecrets.org, Southern Company, the company that received the $8 billion loan guarantee to build the power plant in Georgia, spent $13 million on lobbying last year. Tyson Slocum is director of the Energy Group for Public Citizen. He says their efforts are paying off.
When you look at the merits of which technologies ought to be receiving subsidies, nuclear power would be at the bottom of the list. But when you look at what the priorities of the Obama administration and Congress have been, nuclear power is at the top. The only explanation is the lobbying influence of the nuclear power industry is trying to mask the fatal flaws of the technology.
President Obama is also calling for a bipartisan group of experts to examine the challenges of nuclear energy. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Tomorrow marks 1 year since the passage of the $787 billion stimulus. About one-third of that money has been spent on direct assistance to states and individuals and on tax cuts. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, some analysts say women and people of color have not seen the benefits of the stimulus.
The economic crisis has had a disproportionate impact on women and people of color. For example, white unemployment sits at about 9% and is falling. Black unemployment is over 16% and rising. Although people of color make up one-third of the American population, they consumed half of the subprime loans. What's worse, says John Powell, executive director of the Kirwan Institute at Ohio State University, is that the recovery is also leaving them behind.
And many of those stimulus packages are not targeted to address the situatedness of those groups.
President Obama has often said that economic programs for everyone will help everyone. John Powell says, not true.
You build an escalator to get people to the seventh floor. That's the goal. And then someone shows up with a wheelchair. It's not enough to say, well, we built something for everyone without recognizing that an escalator can't be used by everyone.
The most prominent example is the fight over transportation funding for the BART public transit system in the San Francisco Bay Area. The proposal was for an airport connector. Groups sued. They said the project would violate the Civil Rights Act because minorities would not benefit from federal funding. But civil rights groups won a major victory on the eve of the stimulus anniversary. The Obama administration withdrew the proposed $70 million for the project Tuesday. The group Transportation Equality Network, a coalition of 300 organizations, released a report in December that says only 5% of transportation contracts have gone to women-owned businesses. Not one has gone to a black-owned business. But this is just one example of many that groups highlighted. Funding is pouring into the green economy, but Dominique Apollon with the Applied Research Center, a media and advocacy group, says a systemic lack of access to those jobs for both women and people of color creates a major disparity.
You know, white men dominate energy sector jobs, for example, you know, as 80% of jobs in those sectors. Black women are only 1.5% of those energy sector jobs.
Apollon and other advocates say the administration needs to be more proactive and deliberate in allocating money. Again, John Powell with the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University.
You don't have to say race if you don't want to, but you do have to say that certain communities are harder hit by subprime, are harder hit by foreclosures, and we need to target those communities.
Advocates say the first step is to start compiling race and gender data on recovery dollars. Although some data is measurable, they say no comprehensive tracking plan is available. Equality advocates also say that inequity in government funds goes beyond the stimulus. It also is evident in major housing assistance programs and financial assistance through the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department. The White House has not yet responded to calls for comment. Meanwhile, Vice President Joe Biden spent the day in Michigan promoting the benefits of the stimulus. He toured a job training center and a solar energy plant to promote stimulus-backed job creation. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
This week, a member of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, a group that uses direct action to end what it considers illegal fishing in the ocean, was taken into custody after he boarded a Japanese whaling vessel. The incident involving Captain Peter Bethune has drawn attention to whaling practices and is part of an escalation of actions between Japan's whaling fleet and the activists. The Japanese government considers the actions of the group illegal. FSRN spoke to Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd ship Steve Irwin. He spoke to FSRN by satellite phone from the ship about 500 miles from the coast of Antarctica. He began by describing what happened when Peter Bethune boarded the Japanese vessel.
Captain Bethune boarded the Japanese whaling fleet security vessel shown in Maru under cover of darkness while it was going along at full speed. It was a very courageous thing and very risky, but he got on board, and he was on board for an hour and a half before he was discovered. He was discovered by simply knocking on the door of the bridge house wheel door and presenting himself. We had that covered by video from our helicopter. He went on board to deliver a message asking the captain of the Shona Maru to go to the nearest New Zealand and Australia port to turn himself in for sinking the Audi Gill and for the attempted murder of six of the Audi Gill crew members. And then the Japanese took him into custody and detained him. And I understand they're on their way to Japan, which I find absolutely amazing that they're sending in a ship for 3 weeks just to carry one person prisoner back to Japan.
And just for a moment to back up a second, it stems from an incident on January 6, 2010 this year. What happened then?
On January 6, the Audi Gill, the Sea Shepherd vessel, it's a fast patrol boat, was sitting still in the water when the Shona Maru number 2 came by, deliberately turned into it, rammed it, cut it in half, sunk it, and destroyed it, and nearly missed killing six of the crew on board. The article was registered in New Zealand. New Zealand did nothing, not even a reprimand or a rebuke to Japan for this, and so Peter Bethune, as a New Zealand citizen, decided that since his government wasn't going to represent his interests, he went on board the Shona Maru to demand that the captain of the Shona Maru address that crime.
And as you say, Peter Bethune is reportedly on his way back to Japan now, possibly to face charges. What would be the charges that he would face?
Well, that'd be very interesting. I can't see what charges he could possibly face. He simply went on board the vessel to present a message to the captain about the sinking of his vessel, the Audi Gill. The Japanese were talking about charging him with piracy. I find it highly ludicrous after that ship had sunk his vessel that they would charge him with piracy for basically protesting the fact that the ship was sunk. They're also saying that he injured three crew members on the Shonan Maru number two on February 11th. They accused him of throwing butyric acid or rotten butter into their face, which caused eye damage. But as it is, we actually videotaped that, and it's on our website. The injuries were self-inflicted when the Japanese tried to hit our crew with pepper spray. And you can see on the video, they pull the trigger on their canisters of pepper spray. The wind blows it back in their faces. You see them rubbing their eyes and obviously irritated. So we have the evidence that, in fact, those injuries were self-inflicted. So that would be a very easy charge for Peter to defend himself on.
Now, to get some context into what is going on, there is a ban on commercial whaling, but Japan has an exception to that. Can you explain what that exception is?
They don't have an exception. They say they have an exception, but it's not as simple as that. They're targeting endangered whales, that is, fin whales, and protected whales, minke whales, are also targeting humpback whales, which are endangered, in an established international whale sanctuary in violation of a global moratorium on whaling and in violation of the Antarctic Treaty. Now, Japan argues, well, they have a right to do this for so-called scientific research, although they have produced a single peer-reviewed international scientific paper in 23 years. But even if they had the right, say, to do it for scientific research, they're in violation of the Antarctic Treaty, which prohibits commercial activity in the Southern Ocean. This is a sanctuary. You don't kill whales in a sanctuary. And they're also in contempt of the Australian Federal Court, which has ruled that they are prohibited from killing whales in the Australian Antarctic Territory, and they ignored that. So what they're doing is criminal. They are poachers. They are no different than poachers who kill elephants in East Africa, except East African elephant poachers are black and they're poor. That's the only difference.
That's Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd ship Steve Irwin. He spoke to us by satellite phone from his ship about recent actions against Japanese whaling practices. In western El Salvador, the Izalco indigenous community is calling for constitutional reforms to protect land rights and to preserve its culture. When President Mauricio Funes was elected with the left-leaning FMLN party last year, he ended years of conservative rule in the country and ushered in hopes of a more progressive agenda. But the government has been slow to take action on this issue. FSRN's Ricardo Martinez reports.
Over a three-day period, thousands of people belonging to the People Indigenous Nation in El Salvador marched 4 miles and took a vow of silence. The People Nation organized the march from Izalco communities to Sonsonate City to demand the return of their ancestral lands seized by landowners and right-wing governments over the past 5 decades. Tito Reyes is the community mayor of Izalco, a municipality in western El Salvador that is formed by 120 communities of the Nahuatl People Nation.
No es justo que mucha gente se haya venido a aprovechar de todas nuestras riquezas.
It is unfair that many people have come to take advantage of our wealth, our values. They stole everything, and today we deal with the suffering, as always. We try to keep what little we have, and we would like the government to really care about the real Indian blood, not for them to just come and make us office when there is a political campaign, but to realize what we truly live through and what we need since our lands were seized.
In 1932,
an estimated 30,000 Izalco people were killed under the dictatorial regime of General Maximiliano Hernández Martínez. Now, the Izalco people are demanding the return of land and land reform to protect them from the risk of losing it again in the future. Juliana Amas is a member of the Council of Elders of Izalco's indigenous communities.
We consider this reform to fit with the Convention 169 of the International Labor Organization, which El Salvador has not yet ratified. We indigenous are still anonymous and discriminated against, with some actions that we, as a people, have the right to claim.
Many indigenous people were optimistic that land reform and autonomy would follow the election of the leftist government last year. The ruling leftist party, FMLN, says it is fighting for indigenous demand. Alfredo Tovar is a local FMLN leader.
Indeed, much of these lands that are in the hands of landlords who incidentally grow coffee has no legal backing and are transfers that were obtained through force, at gunpoint. These are the legal documents that the landowners have. They do not have a legal title deed as required by law. I think there's a willingness from the government to review these cases, and many of these lands that were seized could return to their former owners.
The reform initiative that the people of Izalco proposed includes autonomous decision-making and local government, collective land ownership, the promotion of indigenous culture and language in schools, and a guarantee that water will not be privatized. Ricardo Martinez, Free Speech Radio News, Izalco, El Salvador.
In Vancouver, protesters continue to raise awareness about the impact of the Olympic Games on the city. On the downtown's east side, housing advocates erected an Olympic tent city to raise awareness about affordable housing and homelessness. Activists also want to draw attention to significant civil liberties issues behind the Winter Games. Members of the Olympic Resistance Network point to a number of new laws enacted just for the Olympics that violate civil liberties. FSRN's Adam Vaughn reports.
One of the oldest sporting events, known for spirited international athletic competition, has recently been described as anything but.
The Olympic Games are morally bankrupt.
Chris Shaw is a professor at the University of British Columbia and part of the Olympic Resistance Network. Shaw decided to protest the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics when he learned that the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, mandates that a host country make changes to local law.
The IOC comes into your town, and they basically start dictating what you're going to do for the next 7 years in social policy. You will do the following things. You will change your civil liberties. You will change your financial structures. You will change all of those things for their benefit. And supporting the Games is supporting this bankrupt, morally indefensible event that takes away from society.
For the 2008 Beijing Olympics, the IOC received widespread criticism for awarding the Games to China, a country with a long-standing record of human rights abuses. In terms of protecting liberties, one might think Canada would be on the other side of the spectrum. But dissenters say that once the Olympics were awarded to Vancouver, the government began making changes to law that violate civil liberties. One of the most controversial new bylaws regulates the use of signs. The legislation makes it illegal to post or display a sign that government officials or the Vancouver Organizing Committee, also known as VANOC, deem offensive to the Olympics. The term offensive is broad. It could include, for example, a Pepsi sign. Coca-Cola is an Olympic sponsor, and the IOC has legally bound Vancouver to protect the investment of sponsors like Coca-Cola. Gord Hill is also a member of the Olympic Resistance Network, and from Vancouver, he maintains the No2010.com website. Keeps a close watch on Olympic organizers.
Having a sign in your window saying the Olympics suck. Now, the police will be empowered to enter that residence within 24 hours and remove the sign. The city council signed an agreement with the International Olympic Committee, the IOC. So they have to do this. So that's what we've experienced here. And there's been a huge public outcry about the erosion of civil liberties.
Michael Vaughn is the policy director of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association. They have already filed lawsuits against the provincial government's Olympic-related legislation. The lawsuits allege the new bylaws and provisions violate the Canadian Constitution.
Clearly, there's massive money involved here, and protecting the sponsors is a constant reiterated theme. And how that overlaps with people's democratic freedoms, and you've got to ask yourself, when did the state, the country, the municipality, the province get into the business of policing private sector commercial rights?
Critics say the civil liberty violations extend beyond just these bylaws. The Vancouver government passed the Assistance to Shelter Act, which allows police officers to force homeless individuals into shelters during inclement weather. Vancouver Chief Constable Jim Chu publicly stated the policy will only be used with the best interest of the homeless in mind. But critics like Michael Vaughn question the timing of this new policy just prior to thousands of tourists flooding Vancouver.
There is no possible way to look at that legislation in a benign fashion if you know the context. And the context is we don't have enough shelters for our homeless people. So what that means is that this law will be used selectively and strategically to sweep the homeless out of the business areas, the tourist areas, and anything having to do with the Olympics.
Olympic security costs could reach $1 billion and includes 15,000 police, military, and private security personnel. Nearly 1,000 surveillance cameras were installed by the City of Vancouver and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Critics like Gord Hill say this is overkill and question who the target is for all the Olympic security resources.
I mean, originally, their whole thing was a potential terrorist attack by Al-Qaeda and all this kind of stuff. And now they know in their intelligence reports, there's no evidence of that at all. The main concern are these anti-Olympic protesters. Now it's the domestic opposition, which is their main target. And so we have been targeted by intelligence service and other police agencies. We've seen the establishment of this Olympic police state.
Activists say police have targeted their groups, and some have been visited and questioned by intelligence agents. Additionally, a number of journalists flying and driving across the border have been stopped and questioned for hours regarding their intentions in Vancouver. A few have even been denied access into Canada. Despite the threat of police harassment, the Olympic Resistance Network says they'll continue protests and holding media summits throughout the duration of the Olympics. Adam Vaughn, Free Speech Radio News.
To hear the rest of Adam Vaughn's series on the Olympics, go to our website, fsrn.org. And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.
This is Rebecca Miles from WBAI Radio. As many of you know, WBAI Pacifica Radio is financed through listener donations. In fact, without the support of listeners, we'd have no radio station. We couldn't broadcast. There'd be no staff or producers. About four times a year, we have to ask for money to operate, and a donation to WBAI, however big or small, supports independent media. Our content isn't vetted by the needs and interests of stockholders or the whim of Wall Street. It's for this reason, on Wednesday, February the 3rd, we begin our winter on-air drive with a goal of $800,000 and above. We need volunteers to answer the telephone, so come to 120 Wall Street between South and Front Streets in Manhattan. You'll need photo ID and call Vera at 212-209-2826 to tell her you're coming.
WBAI would like to thank the following food donors for their generous donations during our winter fund drive. Alpha Noose Middle Eastern Cuisine on Maiden Lane. Tandoor Palace Indian Restaurant on Fulton Street. Papa John's Pizza on John Street between Broadway and Nassau. Moustache on East 10th Street in the East Village between 1st Avenue and Avenue A. They also have a location in Harlem. Wall Street Wine Merchants on Pine Street. Please remember to thank these donors for supporting WBAI when you visit their establishments. We also like to thank Matt Mazza, Mitch Cohen, and Indra Harder from the WBAI Cafe for providing meals for our amazing volunteers.
And thank you very much for that. We certainly want to thank all of the area restaurants who donated food, who are donating food to our effort here during our winter fundraising drive. It's 7 p.m. in New York City at 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.org. Usually at this time, you'd be tuning in to Tahrir, Voices of the Middle East, here in the U.S. and abroad with Barbara Nimri Aziz, the host and producer of that show. They'll be back later on in this fundraising drive. But right now, we present to you a rebroadcast of The Sweet Science of Racism, produced by Robert Knight.
And this is WBAI New York. My name is Robert Knight, and let us now begin. We are offering to you, as an incentive for the learning of history, and the avoidance of its repetition, a very special package. It is, I call it the sweet science of racism in Haiti. And although that is a pugilistic term from the sweet science of bruising, as a British writer originally wrote in the 1820s, it was popularized in the 1950s here in the United States, and refers to boxing and fighting. But there's another reason for that title, and that is the sweet science of sugarcane, of plantations, of the annihilation of the local population, the clearing of fields, the granting to the European aristocracy plantations in which the sugar and coffee crops of the island that has many names, Haiti, Hispaniola, Saint-Domingue, for France, for the French colony on that island, it provided half of the coffee and sugar being produced on this planet Earth. It was harvested by Africans, abducted and brought there under the most severe form of slavery, and measured to the very month of the length of their lives in the amortization of the finances thereof. At the end of the 18th century and early 19th century, there was a magnificent rebellion by those slaves and former slaves. And from that day and before, the United States of America has put its boot on every square inch of the neck of the aspirations of the liberated African people of Haiti. We can talk about that a lot, but tonight I thought it would be more useful for us to hear the actual words of the deciders of the time. And among those we will be hearing from are Napoleon Bonaparte, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Bartolome de las Casas, and others. Howard Zinn as well. And what we are doing to ask you to support the operation of this radio station, a non-commercial, listener-funded radio station of the Pacifica Radio Network. Our mission, our charter, our principles say that we are an educational institution with an independent financial base. Your donations are tax-deductible, and we accept any amount tax-deductible that you wish to give. The way to give and keep a radio station that is non-commercial with ethical voices and informed comment with the leading edge of art, with dedication to looking at the differences among cultures and conflicts among people and seeking a resolution that can lead to a more peaceful world. The way you support this daring project in the increasingly corporatized media is with a call to us. We have volunteers here at this hour in this snow at area code 212-209-2950. Now, if you've been listening to BAI and listening to Earthwatch and many of the other programs on this air, you know that you are going to be treated with respect for your intelligence and your need to know. I believe that in the contemporary debate and discussions about the horrible geological tragedy that occurred almost to this day, it's one day short of a month from the most recent devastating earthquake that destroyed perhaps 250,000 people. This is why we're doing this tonight. We are offering you, as an incentive for this educational project regarding the history and people of Haiti, two things. We have a special package which is an educational documentary of the words from the horse's mouth of the people who helped build a centuries-long establishment of international racism in regard to Haiti. The voices that I mentioned, we will hear their original words from the 1700s to the present time. Something to think about when you understand the role of Bill Clinton and George W. Bush in Haiti today. We will consider the other meaning of the word sugar, the plantations where to this day children and the impoverished of Haiti are taken in work camps to the Dominican Republic to harvest cane and other crops. Melquiladores, there are people whose travel documents are taken and who are still in what is a contemporary form of slavery or indenture. To help understand that, we are offering you two things. The historical documentary of how Haiti became underdeveloped. And we have secured, for those who make a call and make a pledge to WVAI at this time, a new translation of the seminal book on what happened in Haiti even before the travesty of the slave importation and that great human holocaust. There was yet another before that of the indigenous people, the Arawak, the people known as the Caribs and the Tainos. And we're going to hear some samples, some excerpts from this documentary. Here's the deal. We need your support. You need our information. Give us a call at 212-209-2950. For a price of $100, you receive not only the audio documentary with these historical acoustic documents, but also a summary review of current developments in Haiti. For $100, you get the audio documentary, The Sweet Science of Racism in Haiti, as well as this book, A Brief Account of the Destruction of the Indies. This is chilling reading, people. It is the eyewitness account of a Spanish priest who observed firsthand what happened to the Indians on that island and who was there during the transition to the African slave trade and who repented and documented in great detail a history that's neglected when you tune to CNN and so many of the other sensation-seeking media outlets. $100, the book and the multi-CD set of the documentary of the history of Haiti from the horse's mouth, the words of the people who created the conditions being suffered today in Haiti. For $50, you can get the book, or for $50, you can get the audio documentary. But I am trusting our listeners and hoping that the more enlightened among you will be the first to call while we have people here. Area code 212-209-2950. And as soon as we have a show of faith, we will begin with what I hope to pack as much information in tonight's program as possible. But we do need to show that there is a constituency of ethical people seeking education or seeking to share it, giving it to some kids, sharing it with some friends, or just sitting in the middle of the night in a snowstorm and thinking about things bigger than the spur-of-the-moment level of coverage that people try to pretend is education and news in America today. You're tuned to WBAI New York. That name means something. It means independent journalism. It means going where the media mob does not. We're going deep on Haiti tonight, and we would very much like to see a few of you making some calls. In fact, I'm hoping that there's someone listening of sufficient... Thank you. Thank you. Here comes a call. I'm hoping that there's someone there tonight with a sufficient endowment to maybe make a tax-deductible donation to BAI of $1,000 or $500. So that we can use that as a matching fund to get other people to incentivize other people to call and support the station and get this educational package. $100, you get the documentary of the words of Jefferson, Zinn, Napoleon, Washington, De Las Casas, and others. And it's going to knock your socks off. In a minute, maybe I'll give you a little sample of it. 212-209-2950. There's our second call. Thank you. 212-209-2950. if we could just get a little bit of indication here on our primitive tally machine that's operated by wonderful volunteers. Thank you. There's a third call. 212-209-2950. You are supporting a mind that wishes your soul well. You are supporting the mentality of Pacifica Radio, of WBAI. You are saying that you can know more so you can do better. And that's why we are doing this. I guess I promised that once we got a little bit of the beginning, I'm going to trust that maybe there's a couple of $1,000 worth of pledges there. You can get multiple copies of this. $100 more than 100 pages, a book by Bartolomé de las Casas.